And good morning, everybody. It's time for Greenside Up right here on the mighty 690 KGGF. And joining me in studio this morning is Wendy Powell. And yeah, Wendy, if you have the mic up there, it'd be kind of hollow sounding if you have it up there, but because the last thing you looked up, oh, and pull that down.
I'm pretty sure that's a short joke. Thanks, Kyle.
Yeah. well, you're not that short. I mean, well, you're what, 5'5" or something like
Gee,
that?
Gee, thanks.
So. I'm guessing I overestimated. So.
Only a couple inches.
Oh, okay. It's 5'7"? All right. All right. Well, Wendy, thank you for coming in today. We're going to have Jesse Gilmore in on the second part of our program today. But first of all, we'll be talking to Wendy. And again, Wendy, good morning. I hope you are doing well this morning. Hope you had a safe drive in this morning.
Yes. Yeah, over where I came from this morning, we didn't have a lot of snow on the ground, so definitely more as I came east.
Yeah, a little dusting here in Coffeyville. I just had to run the windshield wipers once and twice and then kind of moved all the snow off. So at least it was kind of the snow that's easy to, you don't have to scrape it or anything like that. All right. Well, again, it's good to have you in this week. And what is your topic for this week?
Well, I am excited to visit with you a little bit about cattle handling facilities and some of the things that go with that. But I first wanted to touch on a few programs that we're going to be hosting. And the first of those coming up is Winning the Grain Game, and that's going to be held in Erie. It's a daytime program. It's going to focus on marketing crops, so that'll be a great in-person program. If you want more information on that, they can call the Altamont Extension Office, 620-77-784. There we go, 620-784-5337. And then we've got our Evidence of Improvements program that's going to happen on the evening of March 1st, and that's going to be a virtual opportunity for folks. We're going to talk about livestock production records and how we can use them to see improvements in our herds, and that's going to be all species, a virtual program. We don't have a lot of marketing out yet because it's not till March 1st, but I am looking forward to that program. On April 8th, we are going to have a sheep and goat management meeting focusing on vaccine handling and animal health. So that's going to be an evening program as well. And at this point in time, it's likely going to be an in-person and virtual opportunity. So that'll be a great place for some small ruminant livestock production operations to get together and discuss different opportunities there. For animal health. So to slide on into the cattle handling facilities, I've entertained several phone calls the last few weeks about how to redesign or completely start over with several different sorts of facilities. So I guess with winter, there's a few things that you can focus on. One is feeding, one is production records or financial records. And the other one is handling facilities. So having some cow sense or animal sense in general is helpful whenever you're designing these facilities because, you know, cattle, their eyes are farther out on their head, so they can actually see 300 degrees around them. Their only blind spots are right behind them. So for humans, we can see about 180. Maybe 190, our peripherals
right
there. But cattle have some amazing peripheral ability. I'm not even sure if I'm saying that word.
No, right. No, you're saying right, peripheral vision, basically where you can see to your side by not moving. You just kind of shift your eyes back and forth.
Yes.
And, of course, that's also why cows get nervous when you get behind them. That's why they kind of kick or something like that, because all of a sudden they know, they kind of sense you behind them, but they're not sure, so they're like, they kick just to make sure, you know, you're not bothering them.
Uh-huh. Yep, they have a really big bubble. Don't get in my bubble.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so with this 300 degree sight, they can actually, I mean, they're a prey animal, so they are on the lookout all the time for any sort of danger. And so whenever they have a handling facility that caters to that need, then they work a lot smoother. The other thing about this wide vision is compromise is focused. They can't focus their eyes quite as quickly. They their vertical vision, whenever they look up and down, is also a lot smaller than ours. And so they have to lower their head to get sight of something that's on the ground. So if they've got a cat or something that's running out in front of them, depending on how fast that cat might be, they might not be able to focus very quickly on that. And it might create some alarm. So with all of these sight situations in a cow, you can design your facility to cater to that. So curved alleys would help. Because the cow, they have this innate desire to want to escape. They don't like to be confined. I don't know too many humans that really like to be confined right. either. So they're going to be looking for that escape route. And if they have a curved alley, especially when it's the same color, their depth perception is not nearly as good as ours. So if it's the same color, they're just going to keep following it. If it's well lit from above, because some good lighting is also a priority there if your facility is under a roof. And that's just going to help with the shadows. So just really keep an whenever you're working on your facilities, just consider all of those limitations. The lighting, the wider ability to see. Curved alleys, like I mentioned, are a good idea, and solid sides. So whenever those alleys are actually solid and you don't have light streaming in from gaps in panels or whatnot, then that's going to decrease their desire to look out, but also it's going to prevent any shadows from crossing their vision and just keep things flowing quite a bit smoother.
Yeah, because some of the shadows could freak them out. They may think, oh, it's a predator, and they'll want to take off running.
Sure, yes. And also when you're working cattle, oftentimes I hear folks, they dress in layers. So you start working cattle whenever it's cold, and then you shed a layer and you just hang that jacket or extra shirt on a fence post. Well, if there's a breeze and that starts flapping, that creates some crazy shadow that a cow doesn't necessarily understand, especially whenever we're talking about stalkers, those smaller animals that they don't have as much life experience. They're a little bit more skittish. So when they see that flapping around or even just hear it, it is a pause. I'm, oh my goodness, what's that? I am in danger, so I'm not going to go ahead. I'm just going to stay right here, or I'm going to back up where I know I was safe. So also, when I mentioned hearing that shirt flap, cattle have they can hear lower and higher volumes than we can. So oftentimes, we think that when we drive into a pasture to feed cows, that they see the feed truck and they just come a-running. Well, more likely, it's because they hear the feed truck. They know what it sounds like, and so come to that if it's a good sound or if it's an experienced sound that they've heard before and they don't like it, then they go the other way.
That's kind of why their ears are constantly moving. They're just kind of listening to everything going on around them, correct?
Yes. Yeah, they don't have as much range of movement as, say, a horse or a dog, but they certainly can move them a little bit. And they are bigger, and the shape of those ears are so that they can capture those sounds. But the compromise that we have with those ears is they can't quite pinpoint the sound. So I read that humans can pinpoint sound up to 5 degrees of its position. So when you hear something, you can pretty well look it in the eye. However, cattle, it's more like 30 degrees or maybe even a little bigger than that. So they just kind of look in the direction. And as I mentioned, that vision is not super, super great. So if it's something that they hear that they are familiar with, like that feed truck, and they know it's going to bring them something tasty, then they'll probably just start heading in that direction. And then as they get closer, kind of veer off or correct their course.
They're like, oh, I hear that thing that brings us food. So let's mosey on over there and get some more food, basically.
Yes. Yes.
So and also the other thing you were talking about, the curved alleyways, is that prevents them from basically freaking out and running because it kind of keeps them calm, correct?
Yes. So they don't necessarily, when as they're starting into that curved alley, they don't necessarily see the escape through the chute and head gate, but they do know that there's something past where they are, so they can keep going. And oftentimes, if you've got good crowding alleys and gates that will crowd them up into the triangle and into the alley, then they don't have room to back up. I've seen lots of facilities that have some really, really great backstops. So as that cow or stalker moves up through the alley, then that butt stop will come down past their tail head and prevent the cow from backing up. And that just creates a nice flow for the next animal to come in line. And especially if you've got a nice quiet chute, the cows can just work right on through there and you won't have a lot of problem. But it does take some cow sense to really consider all these factors. And I have worked with a little bit Dr. Joe Horner with K-State, and he's our kind of our facilities specialist. So if anybody has questions about designing a facility or reworking what they already have, give me a holler. I can bring the drone out and we can take some overhead pictures of what you have. We can maybe get Dr. Horner on the line and chat with him. He can give us some insight about what might be best for your cattle operation as well as the actual layout of your facility. There's no one design that's going to work for everyone. Just because you've got hills and trees and fence lines to work with, and so you can't just have a cookie cutter set of pens that's going to be perfect for everyone. And that goes for all species.
Right, because like I said, every land is different. Not every land is just completely flat or has the same amount of hills. Again, it's got to be something that fits in with what you're working with.
That's right. Yes, exactly. And the other things that we have to consider, if these are facilities that are going to be used daily, like stalker operations, we want to consider drainage. So slope is really important so those pens don't get too muddy. If it's a facility that only gets used twice a year, you know, for some spring vaccinations and then, you know, branding time or whatnot, then it can be a little bit simpler. You don't have to worry as much about all of that because it has time to dry out between usage.
And you were talking about bringing the drone out. That's been a great technology for farmers and ranchers because it kind of gives them an overhead look mm-hmm. of what's going on. That's been a pretty good technology for farmers and ranchers, hasn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of different uses for it. I think it had a really great, when drones first started becoming available and affordable for farmers and ranchers, there was all these great big ideas, and some of those haven't quite panned out. But yeah, I think they do have still some usage looking for cattle in really big open pastures. Or like I've mentioned with this facilities, we can get some nice overhead pictures and get the layout, the lay of the land, if right. you will, and create some good plans.
I know if I was controlling a drone, I'd probably crash it within seconds after liftoff. Because if it's anything like the drone I use on my video game, I don't do very well on that. I end up crashing it quite constantly.
I don't think it's quite the same. I'm not a gamer, so I don't know.
But no, I know. I would. I mean, I had trouble with RC trucks when I was a kid, so I don't know about flying something at the same time. If anybody may be just tuning in, obviously I've been talking about that today. Also, there are a few workshops that are coming up as well. If somebody's just tuning in, what are a few of those workshops that you guys will be having coming up?
Yeah. So the February 23rd, we'll be doing the Winning the Grain Game program. That's going to be over at Erie during the day. And that's, again, February 23rd. And then on March 1st, we're going to have an evening virtual meeting that's going to focus on livestock production records. We're calling that Evidence of Improvements, Kyle, so that folks can see their beginning point and hopefully see where they're headed and show evidence of improvements in their operation. April 8th, we're going to be doing a sheep and goat management workshop focusing on vaccine handling and other health aspects of small ruminants. And at this point, that is going to be in person and virtual. It's going to be the evening of April 8th. That might change. You know, we are in a pandemic and our rules are changing all the time. So
it got to be very fluid during these times.
Yes, yes. And April 8th, that's still quite a ways out. Mm-hmm. So for now, we're planning it to be in person and virtual.
All right. So some good workshops coming up. And if anybody wants to register for those, how can they do that?
Yeah, they can ask any questions or register for any of these. Call the Altamont Extension Office, 620-784-5337. And also, we try to send out some timely emails. If anybody would like to see those and they're not getting them, they can call that same phone number, or they can look us up on Facebook and have us add you to the email list. We have an Ag Alert email that goes out with all of our different meetings. And then I also do a no bulletin email. No bulletin, you know. It's my animal science newsletter. I've got various topics on there. I try to send that out the first or second Saturday of the month. And then our crop production agent, James Coover, does a root review, which is also really informative for those row crop producers.
All right. So puns, you have them. So yes. All right. Well, Wendy, again, thank you so much for coming in today. We really do appreciate it. And we'll talk to you again here in, I guess, not next week, but the week after.
Yes.
All right.
I'll stick around if there's anything to cover later.
Awesome. So we'll talk about that here in just a minute. And Jesse, I know he is hanging out on the line, but we'll come to him here in just a few. Let's go to him just real quickly. And Jesse, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. What are you going to be talking about in the next segment?
So the Pear Horticulture Center has just completed some research on the effects of grass for newly planted trees. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And I'm also going to bring up some basic breeding principles for the average gardener and what they can do to ensure that traits that they have in their garden plants and their vegetables can be passed down to future generations through pollination. It doesn't take a lot to be a plant breeder, and you don't need to be like an employee of a university in order to employ some breeding principles in your own garden.
All right. Well, Jesse, we'll have that coming up here on the other side of the break. So please hang on. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.
Coffeeville's historic radio station, AM 690 KGGF.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Greenside Up here on this Wednesday morning hump day here in Southeast Kansas. And let's go ahead and get back to the phone as we are talking to Jesse Gilmore from one of the K-State Extension offices here in Southeast Kansas. And Jesse, good morning. How are you doing today, sir?
Good morning. I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Wendy is joining us as well. And Jesse, for those that may be just tuning in this morning, what are we talking about this morning?
So we're going to start off talking about some research that was just completed at the Pear Horticulture Center in Hayesville regarding best practices for how to treat newly planted trees. And then a little later, we're going to talk about plant breeding for the average gardener, and how to save seed so that you can get the traits that you want out of your garden vegetables and other ornamental plants in your garden.
All right, so let's go ahead and get started.
Okay, so starting off, Pear Horticulture Center recently published some research regarding best practices for newly planted trees and whether or not to let grass grow up to the base of them. It's kind of a mixed bag of answers whenever you ask someone if you should allow plants to grow right up to the base of a tree or if you should instead maintain a bare spot or a mulched ring around the base, which is better for the tree long-term and allows it to have better growth. The research center basically did five different treatments for new redbud and pecan seedling. Obviously, this is going to change slightly based on what species you try to grow. For example, walnuts, you won't get very many plants growing right up to the base of the tree because of a chemical they excrete called juglone, which serves as a natural herbicide in order to maintain a competitive edge over nearby plants. But for redbuds and pecan trees, they had five different treatments. The first is that the base of the newly planted tree was kept bare with grass-killing herbicides. The second is that the area under the tree was mulched 3 inches deep. The third is that tall fescue was allowed to grow under the tree. The fourth is that Kentucky bluegrass was allowed to grow under the tree. And then the fifth was that Bermuda grass was allowed to grow under the tree. All trees were fertilized the same during the growing season and given up to 1 inch of supplemental water if rainfall was deficient. At the end of 2 years, trees were measured and data was collected on the diameter of the tree, newly planted tree 6 inches above the ground, the weight of above ground portions of the tree, leaf area, and leaf weight. It was found that there were no differences between the mulched treatment and the bare soil treatment for either species, but both of them show much better growth overall than if grass was allowed to grow up around the tree. Starting with caliper, which is the size or diameter of the trunk at a certain height above ground, in this instance, because the trees were only a couple of years old when they planted them, caliper was measured 6 inches above the soil surface. And the research showed that the size of the tree was twice as large for bare soil and for mulch as it was for trees where bluegrass or fescue was allowed to grow up to the base, and 50% larger than where Bermuda grass was allowed to grow up to the base. So Bermuda grass, not as impactful on the size of the tree as bluegrass or fescue would be. And that kind of tracks because of the lower nutrient and water requirements of Bermuda grass when compared to the cool season grasses. But it is still, it still has a negative impact on the size of the tree compared to keeping the area around the tree bare. Red buds showed a 300% top growth weight advantage for plots with grasses controlled, and pecans showed a 200% advantage. So pecans had twice the top growth rate in trials where the base of the tree was had no grasses, and redbud showed a 3 times weight advantage compared to grass being present. And then for leaf area and leaf weight, leaf areas were 200% larger in plots without grass competition, and leaf weight showed a 300% increase. So the trees are growing more leaves, and they're growing bigger leaves, bigger and heavier. Naturally, this will help newly established trees build up energy reserves more quickly and more quickly get to a mature height in the landscape when compared to allowing grass to grow up around the base. And it kind of depends on what you need out of the tree, whether or not you should allow grass to grow up to the base, because obviously it's still growing while the grass is at the base. And in a lot of cases, if these trees are planted in yards, you want a consistent aesthetic to your yard and your tree. Luckily for Bermuda grass, luckily for the tree, Bermuda grass does not like shade at all. If your tree is starting to cast a large shadow over where the Bermuda grass could be growing, it will not grow there, and you will likely need to put a mulch ring around the base. But if you do decide to put a mulch ring, which is arguably the best treatment for newly planted trees, you want to make sure to not put the mulch too deep. There is a condition called stem girdling roots, which is caused when the roots of certain trees are starved of oxygen. They come up to the surface in order to get the oxygen needed for respiration, and they can end up circling a tree and choking it to death. In the industry, back when I worked in landscaping, we derisively called those mulch volcanoes. So that is something to be avoided. But mulching has a lot of other benefits, including moderating the soil temperature during the summer and winter, increasing moisture retention, and weed prevention. in the yard.
And Jesse, you were talking about, you know, how Bermuda grass does not like, you know, any kind of shade. That's why a lot of times you don't see grass growing right up to a tree trunk, correct?
Yes. So I would say that probably most of the yards down here in Wildcat District will be a mix of Bermuda and tall fescue. And there's a couple of reasons people go for a mix. It's a kind of hedging your bets against a particularly dry summer or a particularly cold fall or spring. Fescue is a cool season grass. Bermuda grass is a warm season grass. And that just describes the periods of time where they will be dormant. Cool season grasses will go dormant during the summer and then break out of their dormancy for a second green period in the fall, whereas warm season grasses will stay dormant during the spring and fall and be green in the summer. So you basically have three growing seasons where at least part of your yard is going to be green. And so in mixed yards, you will see in areas of shade under trees, the fescue go up to the base of the tree. Bermuda grass does not like shade at all and will mainly stay in areas where they can get full sun about 8 hours a day out of the yard. So typically you won't have to worry about Bermuda grass growing up to the base if you want to keep the base clear of grass in order to give it that competitive advantage and allow for the early growth. Which is good because Bermuda grass is very hard to control with herbicides. But you might still have to be concerned with tall fescue if your yard is a mix of grass species.
All right. So let's go ahead and move on. Sorry I interrupted you there. You're about to move on to the next subject.
Yes. So I've noticed a growing interest in breeding plants. Not necessarily actively breeding, but saving seed in order to have ornamentals and vegetables for future growing years. And there's a lot of questions asked about how to get desirable characteristics from one generation of plants to the next. It really depends on whether or not you have hybrid or heirloom seeds. Hybrid seeds, these are going to be the seeds marketed more to commercial vegetable growers. I'm speaking from the vegetable perspective right now, but a lot of what I'm going to say also applies to ornamental plants, particularly annual flowers. Hybrid seeds are seeds that have been backcrossed and are typically marketed with particular characteristics. This will be yield, this will be size, this will be disease and insect resistance. Unfortunately, when dealing with seeds from hybrid plants, you're not going to end up with plants that are what's known as true to type when they are pollinated. The characteristics of hybrid plants are going to vary greatly from generation to generation. When you are dealing with plant breeding as the average gardener, you need open pollination in order to have plants that are true to type or have the same characteristics as the parent plant. When plants are open pollinated, they undergo mitosis and meiosis, and they basically have the genes from both parent plants passed down to the seeds that will end up in your garden next year. So you have to make sure that the plants that are pollinating each other both have the same characteristics that you want. A lot of the times, gardeners will cull out plants that don't have the desirable characteristics before they can actually pollinate other plants. There are some other ways to prevent cross-contamination of plants that don't have the characteristics you want. The first is to make sure that the plants that have different characteristics are far enough away so that they aren't pollinated. a lot of the times pollination, we think of pollination as happening solely by insects, like bees, moths, and the like. But it turns out just as frequently, pollination occurs by wind. So maintaining a distance between plants with different characteristics that you want separate will cut down on potential cross-contamination in terms of pollination. There is also mechanical prevention, which can be as simple as covering the unopened female flower of a bee-pollinated plant with a bag and then hand-pollinating the male flowers of the same variety. By covering the flower, obviously, you prevent most insects from getting to it and also prevent wind contamination. The last thing that you can use is the timing of flowering. This will typically be for named varieties, even in the same species of garden plant. The timing of the flowering can vary enough to where some flowers are open while others are not, and if the flowers are open at the same time, those varieties will be pollinated together, whereas the other ones that open later will not be. You see this a lot on fruit trees, particularly with apples. In catalogs, you will see apple trees listed as flower timing just as frequently as varieties. So those are a few ways to prevent cross-contamination. I would definitely recommend people get into, or at least try experimenting with seed saving, because it's an interesting way to see the genetics of garden plants in action, and it's also a good way to cut down on the costs of gardening by reducing your seed costs in future growing seasons.
All right. Well, Jesse, again, thank you so much for coming on. If anybody has any questions about what you've talked about today, how can they get a hold of you?
They can call my office at 620-724-8233. They can email me at jr637@ksu.edu. And they can also follow the new Facebook group that we've established called Gardening and Landscapes in the Wildcat Extension District. I'll be posting little tidbits of information like that on a weekly basis. And if you follow the group, you will get those weekly updates.
All right. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for coming on today. We really do appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. You have a great day.
You too.
All right. And Wendy Powell still in studio with us this morning. And Wendy, before we get out of here, if somebody is just joining us, you guys do have some workshops coming up.
Yes, we do. On February 23rd, we're going to do a Winning the Grain Game marketing program that's going to take place during the day in Erie. On March 1st, we've got our program called Evidence of Improvements, and that's going to focus on livestock production records. That's going to be a virtual event in the evening. And then April 8th, we've got Sheep and Goat Management, focusing on vaccine handling and health. And that's going to be an evening program as well. But hopefully, at that point, we'll be able to offer a hybrid in-person and virtual opportunity.
All right. So, again, some good programs coming up. And, Wendy, I thank you for coming in today as well with everything you talked about today. I really do appreciate it. And we'll see you again here in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we'll have open line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.